Oh, it's always nice. I was here for almost 10 years, and I think I lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else, so it always feels a little bit like home. Even, you know, it always changes. It's right. Never the same place when I return, but it still has a certain feel to it.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Well, good.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it actually makes me feel a little bit better that you hadn't fully prepared,
okay,
because
good.
I was going to ask you a potentially unfair question, which
fine.
Is just to, you know, kind of see if you could describe your relationship with John and maybe, you know, any fond memories that really stick out to you.
I had a good relationship with John. Graduate student faculty relations are always complicated in a certain kind of way, and then boss worker relations are complicated in a slightly different way, and he was both of those things for me. I don't think I ever took a class with him, but I worked in the CWRL for years and years with him. I had some idea to try to count them up, but I mean, 6 or 7 years, I was there for a long time. And so I think I knew him relatively well, and I have great fondness for him. What I appreciated about him in large part was both that he was a kind of an intellectually inquisitive person, and often found myself sort of having drinks or coffee or something with him and getting into conversations that I found really productive. But he was also a kind of a pragmatic person and somebody who was able to kind of get things organized and get things done and get money and make budgets and so forth. And so there was a lot of, you know, really good working relationships. I don't have an anecdote or anything that leaps to my mind other than one phrase that I stole from him and that I remember him saying, you should quote me when you steal this, and I think I did in my dissertation, and he and I were talking about sort of what's now often called corporate social responsibility or something along these lines, this move towards a certain kind of philanthropic lending profile that a lot of the high-end corporations were doing. And I remember him saying it's like venture philanthropy in the sort of heyday of venture capitalism here in Austin, where all the dot-coms were all looking around for their sort of sugar daddy benefactors, and money was flowing pretty freely in the 90s. And there was this sense of, How does that venture capital return a profit? And I remember us thinking about the ways in which philanthropy and a lot of sort of tech lending for education and for other kinds of things has this sort of underside of where is the return of profit on it? So that phrase of venture philanthropy stuck with me. I've used it once or twice before, and I always think about John and him saying, yeah, you should feel free to use it. Remember to cite me when you do. So
right.
I'll cite him in this interview among
good.
Other places.
Good. Given that kind of venture philanthropy and what technology was doing in education, you know, one of the questions that I asked was, that I wanted to ask you was, you know, how do you see the shifting role of technology in the university right now? How does that affect those apprenticeship relationships or professorial relationships?
Yeah. I'm not in a great position to answer this because I don't know that my university is particularly emblematic of broader transformations in higher ed or in education in general. At Albany, I mean, I think I was seeing this here as well to a certain degree. There was always a lot of money for putting in a new sort of smart classroom, something or other, a podium with a projector, and some sort of tech money that was available, and that it becomes part of the profile of the university to have, you know, classrooms filled with this. But there was never really any money for funding staff and systems and organizations and so forth into which that technology was going to be used. And it seems to me that continues. I remember seeing it and thinking about it when I was here. And it certainly continues apace in Albany today. The move towards sort of off-the-shelf, you know, prefab solutions to everything, the sort of Blackboard world and WebCT, I guess WebCT was bought by Blackboard,
right.
I don't know, that ongoing kind of mergers and stuff where it seems to be moving apace, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised. I've fallen out of the crowd of people who really were trying to press to do things on their own, to kind of work on open source projects, to build and design things that weren't in that model. And I, you know, I regret that to a certain degree. You know, when you move to a different institution and the settings are different and so forth, sometimes things slide. So I don't know that I'm in a great position to comment on a broad kind of state of technology and education today, other than to say, you know, education in general moves towards a closer and closer relationship with corporate America all the time, and technology is always a part of that. That said, I'll say one caveat as a way of kind of, in general, I see this move in that direction towards the corporatization of the university and so forth. That said, I always think that you can do a lot of interesting things with tools that weren't meant to be interesting, and there's always room for creative adaptation and sort of working. The tool itself doesn't determine its use. You know, the people who put it to use in interesting ways are the ones who really put the content into the relationship between technology and education. And so the kinds of essays that I see occasionally and the kinds of projects that I see which simply decry the fact that everything is now off-the-shelf Blackboard, whatever, another, as though the fact that commercial software or the fact that sort of commercial relations with computers are the dominant strand, and that as if that precludes doing interesting things with them. I'm not so sure that the coolest open source software is any more useful without a smart, thoughtful pedagogue than Blackboard is. And so, you know, it's that relationship that continues to interest me, even as I pull back from it. Yeah.
Well, and that's always a negotiation, right? I mean, they are institutions of higher education, and as such, there's always seeming complicity with all the other institutions that are backing us.
One often feels, though, that you know, universities are a potential place where you could do some work against some of those things, and you know, it even seems like there are fiscal arguments to be made for hiring a few staff and having them build things and do specific work with faculty, as opposed to spending enormous amounts of money on sort of, you know, web in a box kinds of solutions that are perhaps easier in the sense that everyone's doing it and whatever. But you know, you almost think that you could make a pretty convincing case to administrators that are trying to cut every single corner they can to save a penny here and there, but that those arguments have gone nowhere. So, it's a strange kind of, and, you know, dispiriting in certain kinds of ways, relationship.
Mm-hmm. So, I wonder then, you know, those up-and-coming professors, junior faculty, current graduate students who are training in those tech modes, it's a little bit unfair for me to ask you to forecast, but, you know, given this assertion that it seems like institutions would rather focus on the technology, the products themselves, than sort of a systemic hiring of staff and things like that. I mean, what's that relationship between graduate students and technology, and how do you sort of cultivate that?
That's a tough question. A couple things come to mind. One is that there are certain institutions and certain places that do have dynamic, active programs where technology is being thoughtfully applied and engaged with critically in a variety of ways. So it's not to say that this is happening everywhere, or, you know, that there's nowhere to go outside of Austin where you'll be able to find these things. I think there are institutions who continue to do similar kinds of good work. Secondly, the thing that as I've said, I've moved away, and I don't do much of sort of tech building anymore. I mean, I wouldn't mind trying again at some point in the future, but I don't know exactly how that'll play out. But what I would say is that none of that was wasted. I think that the reason I got a job was because I had a lot of background in technology, and I'd done a lot of really hands-on work. I'd written some textbooks. I'd developed some software. I'd taught with it extensively, and it was an important part of my my professionalization here. So I think it had material effects in terms of getting me a job, even if the job turned out to be not a sort of a tech job, or at least as I turned it into, not a tech job. They had hoped, I suppose, that I would probably do more. But the thing that I think more than anything else is that the self-reflective kinds of metacritical conversations that emerged about the relationship between technology and pedagogy were the ones that were most that made the biggest impression on me in terms of crafting my own sense of a teacher. That is, I have a feeling that a lot of the tools that are used in the lab and so forth are very useful, but the thing that they do more than anything else is make you think about your own investments and objectives and sort of philosophical frameworks that you want to engage in as a teacher. It's not the technology itself, it's the fact that it makes you question some of those relationships that would otherwise be more difficult to tease out. That is, we've all been trained in sort of traditional classrooms where the teacher goes in, talks for a while, students talk for a while, and so forth, and it's easy to slip into that role in a certain kind of way without too much metacritical engagement, but that the presence of computers and the challenge of working in the lab was to say, yeah, to think about what was lost and what was gained in some of those relationships. And it was that kind of self-reflexivity about the methods of teaching that I think was the most useful part of the training for me. And I would assume that that transfers for the other students who are teaching and working in the lab too. And I think there's lots and lots of room. I think universities want there to be that it looks good to have worked with technology. They'll want to hire people who've done that. I think there's lots of space for faculty starting new jobs to carve out a niche. And if building and working in technology and pedagogy is something that's important to you, I think you'll be able to maintain those things, even if it may be more difficult than it is here. It requires the kind of labor of people that create some of the infrastructure that it requires. That's always a battle. They fought the battle here before I got here. I mean, it's always an ongoing battle too, but an initial space was carved out before I got here, and so I was lucky enough to sort of walk into it. But that doesn't mean that those battles can't be fought at other universities and labs set up and things done and so forth. So, you know, build it and make it work for you if that's what you want it to do.
Absolutely. So can you talk a little bit now about, you know, what were sort of the stated goals of the lab while you were here, and how did John or how did the grad students or, you know, how did some of the other initial faculty members, you know, work to achieve those goals?
Mm-hmm. I think goals emerged after John left the lab. I think there was a great deal of creativity and freedom and openness in the way that John had set up the space. He was interested in those things and wanted other people to be interested in it too. And at least when I first got there, it was a small enough place that the people who were there wanted to be there. It had not yet become sort of a place that people were sort of sent along with the Writing Center as part of the employment arrangement. I don't remember stated goals. I remember freedom and creativity and a kind of exploring things and an openness to doing different kinds of projects at different kinds of times. If there were goals, it was simply to say that this is a new sort of frontier of media. It has a relationship with literary studies and textual production and so forth. It has a relationship with writing instruction and with questions of pedagogy. How might we be able to develop and press some things for our own interests and for perhaps a broader audience that would be of value? And that was the kind of, you know, rubric under which I think we were playing.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. So you had mentioned that you find now, you know, your current work has sort of taken a different turn, or not as much of maybe a tech turn as other people in the lab or some of John's other students.
Right.
And you told me before that you you found John's influence really more powerful sort of in the realm of administration. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. There's a part of me that wants to say John wasn't a great administrator in the sense that he was not always the best with managing details, and that there were occasionally sort of moments where maybe he was interested in something himself and sort of part of a process and not sort of looking up over. But in fact, these are the things that made him a pretty good administrator, actually a really interesting administrator. I have, as I've begun to work more in administration, I was the undergraduate director for a few years. Now I'm the graduate director. I've done a lot of service work in our department, and it seems like this is one component of my academic life these days. Realize how difficult it is to be an administrator, I think, particularly working with graduate students and the complexities of an employment relationship while also being an intellectual mentor. Very, very challenging. And I think that the intellectual and academic labor of being a good administrator is incredibly useful. It carves out a little bit of a space to allow other kinds of work to take place that otherwise would easily be sort of pulled into a more mechanistic, instrumental kind of university logic. I think what John did that was so great was he just said, this is an interesting set of questions. I can get this room in the basement of a building. They're going to give me a few computers, and I can carve out a way for the department and the university to allow students to work there and get some credit for it, and then to give them the freedom to do what they want to do. And I think he spent a great deal of his time, and especially as the labs got bigger and bigger, sort of being a bulwark between the university pressures of where's the financial return on this? What, you know, why aren't these people teaching? Why isn't this, you know, what's the payoff for us? In ways that we didn't really see or always acknowledge and understand. And I think administrators are always put in compromised positions. There's no way to sort of do this with a kind of ideological purity. The people who rail from the left or the right in a university about you know, protecting an idea about carving out some kind of clean, uncomplicit space, don't work as administrators. There's always compromises there, and I think he did a great job of standing in between the pressures of a university and a space that he wanted to kind of leave as relatively open and free and give people room to work. And that was amazing. So that's at an institutional level. And I want to kind of give a lot of credit for how difficult that work was when I don't think I always saw it when I was a graduate student. I think I see it a little bit more clearly now. But I also think that he was a really good administrator in the sense that he had real relationships with the people who he was working with and wanted to engage them intellectually as well as a boss of a lab that had to run and so forth. I think he balanced that role very well. He was a good mentor to me. He talked to me about the questions of profession, about what things might be useful down the road, how I might think about marketing myself. And when I was writing the dissertation, I didn't put him on my committee, I think in part because my relationship was a little too close with him in this other kind of regard. And I had a chapter on information technology in my diss, and I gave it to John and had him read it, and he gave me some really good feedback and thoughtful kinds of comments. he was really sort of one side of my role or world here at UT, and then the academic side was somewhat distinct. And I don't know, looking back at it, I'm not sure why I did that. It felt slightly strange, I guess, to me to put him on a dissertation committee at that stage. I had Lester Fegley on as a rhetorician, but not John. But the mentoring role that he had with me was really important, and I look back on it with great fondness, and I think I learned a lot about how, as a faculty member, one needs to both be generous with students, open to their ideas, allow certain kinds of flexible, creative initiatives to take place. There's always a certain degree of energy from graduate students, a kind of newness, freshness, innovative, a set of energies there that that are wonderful. At the same time, within the context of that, how do you both make sure people get finished with their degrees, make sure people do certain kinds of work and not be exploited? And, those are tough lines to walk. I think he walked them pretty well, all told. There were moments where I was cranky with him while I was there, but as I look back on it, I think that that's a pretty good line. He was both a friend to us, but also clearly a faculty member, an administrator, an academic, and someone who was working to professionalize us. And I think he balanced that set of roles pretty well at the end of the day. Give him a lot of credit.